coming up next on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville. It's Apropos of Something. Co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence, Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss the latest policies affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by Table 44 in Stanton and Moxie Hair Lounge on Preston Avenue in Charlottesville. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville Resistance Radio. I like to say Persistence Radio. Apropos of Something airs live on Saturday mornings from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, it is transformation within and without, love, heartbreak, beauty, and changing the narrative, all accidental themes of today's show. We are inspired by our guest today, Jane Allison, who is called brilliant, often and unapologetically, and an incredible young man, Daniel Fairley II, focused on black male achievement and creating opportunity for black boys and men. We'll talk about the telling of true and untrue stories and about the power of narrative to heal, whether on paper or in the way we live out our lives. Jane Allison is professor of English and director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Virginia. She is a renowned author of many diverse and acclaimed works, including a memoir, four novels, and a book on the craft of writing. Her fascinating and haunting life story informed her memoir, Sisters Antipodes. We'll discuss that and her other acclaimed work. And Daniel Fairley II is here. He is the City of Charlottesville's Youth Opportunity Coordinator, focused on black male achievement, supporting the Charlottesville Alliance for Black Male Achievement. He interned at the White House under the Obama administration, garnering some stellar achievements. We'll discuss his work celebrating and creating opportunity for young black men and boys in Charlottesville and beyond. Speaking of opportunity to be friends with my friend, Nancy, are you there?
From the beyond, I'm here. Ellen, I'm here. I bring the irony of, you know, we could have saved all this time the last 2 years if only someone had just thought to ask the current resident of the White House if he was, you know, in favor of some hypothetical, what do you call it, oppo research. If we just asked him hypothetically, we could have saved Mueller 2 years of his 450-page report. I know.
I have to say, it's very hard to listen to the news these days. We just had an election here in Charlottesville on the Democratic primary. So, I mean, that is one thing that we can do is to stay informed. Do self-care and listen when you can. I will say that, did you hear this little bit of news? The pride flags were banned at U.S. embassies?
I did, in fact. And, you know, they've figured out a workaround, or at least some of the embassies.
Oh, what is it?
Or most of them. They figured out a workaround. What they're doing is just not putting it on the flagpole, because that's officially what the guideline or the stipulation is. You can't fly it, so they're applying it to the embassies, or they're creating or putting it on the gates, or, you know, creating like rainbowish things that are not hanging, hoisted, or whatever the correct word is for a flag. Yes, to answer your question, of course.
That's great news. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, and speaking of this White House and its great policies, today is a national, today itself is a national day of what they're calling local action. There's all over the country, like 100 cities and towns, demanding that Congress, for the last time, to make it plain, that they'd like an impeachment inquiry, please. It's hashtag impeach Trump. It's called the Act to Defend Democracy. It's going on today. Different places. You can go to moveon.org and see if something nearby you can show up to.
That is great.
Yes.
That's great news.
They're not getting the message.
No, they're not getting the message. But speaking of moving on, I'm going to move on.
Yeah.
You can find Apropos of Something's 83 shows on Apple Podcasts, and I love the Overcast app, and at AOS Radio on Twitter and Facebook. So with no further ado, our first guest is Jane Allison. She is professor of English and director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Virginia. She's written a memoir, four novels, a book on the craft of writing, short stories, and more. Her memoir, Sisters Antipodes, is about her fascinating and tragic life story. The first sentence of that work, the Boston Globe wrote, begins with the kind of shockeroo statement guaranteed to win the Best First Sentence Award. Her first novel, The Love Artist, has been translated into seven languages. Another, The Marriage of the Sea, was the New York Times Notable Book of the Year. She has also collaborated on a mini opera based on her books. So welcome to this program, Jane.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So speaking of what the Boston Globe had said was a shockeroo statement, the first sentence of that book, you wrote Sisters Antipodes as a memoir when you realized, I read, that it would be too unbelievable as a work of fiction. So can you tell us what happened?
What happened was, and I wish I could remember that first sentence. You'd think I would.
I have it. Would you like it?
Sure.
Okay. Let's hear it. In 1965, when I was four, my parents met another couple, got along well, and with a few months traded partners.
Yeah, okay. So that's what happened. That's the story. So my parents were Australian diplomats, and they met another family, another couple who were American diplomats, everyone based in Canberra, Australia at the time. And people had said to them, you two have so much in common, you should really meet. And they did meet, and they had a lot in common. They both had little girls the same ages. The men were both these handsome, ambitious fellows. The women were lovely and ambitious in their own ways. And it's true that within a few months they did trade partners very neatly. So the American father went off with my mother and my sister and me, and my Australian father went off with the American woman and her two girls. And this being the Foreign Service, so that means that people went to different sides of the globe. And so we ended up growing up in the North and South America, while my father and his new crew were in Asia mostly. So, and we didn't see each other for 7 years. And so for me, it was a very weird way of growing up in a kind of mirror world, where on the other side of the globe was another family that was exactly a replication of the one I had. And it was also a way of growing up with a lot of competition and jealousy, because I knew this other little girl who actually shares a birthday with me, had my father, got my nationality, got my accent, and she, meanwhile, was thinking probably the same sort of thing about me on the other side of the globe.
When did you realize, Jane, that you wanted to make this public? I mean, I know people that you know about it, but you wanted to turn it into a book and deal with that.
I think I grew up, first of all, I figured that this happened to everyone. And then when I began to tell the story to friends at slumber parties, I realized, oh, no, this is weird. And so it became a story I would tell. Naturally, it was sort of my identifying story. And then I had no plan to be a writer. I studied classics. I studied Latin and Greek after going to public school in D.C. And I then found myself one day walking to a job I had. I was working at Tulane in New Orleans, writing speeches for the president of the university there. And I went into the office one Saturday where I had a computer, which I didn't have at home, and began writing a short story about this. And then I realized, oh, this might be more than a short story. And it turned into many stories. And then I went to grad school, and it became a novel. And it wasn't good as a novel because it was too tidy. And so I had to keep blurring the edges and changing the symmetries. And then I put it aside, wrote other novels that did or did not make it. And then years later, when something happened, when someone died in the story, it suddenly the story took on a shape that made me realize I now had a full form. And also I had to write it, and I had to write it as memoir.
What were the other similarities with the families?
Let's see, within a couple of years of trading partners, each of the couples had a little boy within a week of each other. So there are these two half-brothers who have never met because they're not related technically in any way. They just grew up with the same set of half-sisters and then this story that's haunted them. And they've never had to, I think they've probably both been haunted by it, but they've never had to actually encounter the other halves.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned that you hadn't talked or seen each other actually for 7 years, and I was just wondering, did you guys were young, you know, you and your sister, so did you have any, what was that like for you? Because you were not in a, you know, really in control of your major life decisions at that point, so what was that like?
I was five, so I wasn't in control of much of anything. We were in communication. There were letters that were sent, and because these were two diplomat families, it means that there were diplomatic pouches, and so there'd be this sort of Baroque moment every month or two when the diplomatic pouch would arrive, and my stepfather would bring home the mail, and there would be a letter for my sister and me from our father, and there would be letters for him from his daughters, all having left, you know, the embassy on the other side of the world, and the same thing would be happening from our end. So it was just a kind of curious way of being conscious all the time of those others over there, and yet knowing that we had that we ourselves were something they were conscious of.
What impact did this writing of this memoir have on the characters, the people of your own family?
The actual people.
Yes.
It was, they weren't happy. I mean, I wouldn't be happy either. I don't blame them one bit. But I did try to write something that turned what was pretty complicated and often really painful, because my stepsister and I became extremely competitive in ways that were ultimately fatal, really, and for the love of our respective fathers and for our own self-identities. So it, you know, the story ended horribly in, you know, for her and for many, for everyone else, really. But I felt I had to write this because it was the story of myself, and I couldn't not write it. I wrote four other books before I finally turned back to this. And I told the family that I was doing this and trying to transform something that was painful into something maybe beautiful. And my sister and mother were on my side, and they, you know, they let me download them, and they would give me information, and they would correct me when I was wrong, which I often was. And I wrote to my father and the rest of the family and said, I have written this book, it's going to be coming out, I've tried to do, et cetera, et cetera. And stepfather said, if you write this book, we will no longer have a relationship. And I thought, well, that's a great choice. And my father said worse things than that in a way, but ultimately he came around, having said he wouldn't read the book, he wouldn't acknowledge the book. He ultimately did read the book and came around and was very kind about it. But I would say I burned off one third of the family by writing the book. But I also think that I was doing something that made things clear and honest rather than maintaining a lot of false narratives, because diplomats being diplomats, they have to tell a certain kind of story, and there were certain stories that the adults had that they needed to have, which had to do with protocols and right behavior, whereas things that had happened were hidden. So I felt that I had this thing that I needed to say, and I didn't do it in order to heal myself. I just did it because I'm a writer, and we write what we got to write. And I couldn't, it just was, you know, every day it would sort of surface until I marched down to my office one day and wrote.
And because it was a memoir versus fiction, did your approach to it, just style-wise or process-wise, was there a difference for you?
I had never written in the first person. I'd only written novels and long stories in the third. So this was pretty shocking, because it wasn't just the first person, it was me. And so that was hard. And you have to learn a different way of being honest and different ways of, looking at things like memory, because memory is often false, or it's been reconstructed in a way that it keeps blurring away from what might actually have happened. And so there are ways in writing to work that in and say, you know, what I remember, for instance, is a time when my little brother fell into a swimming pool, and I was trying to swim to the bottom of the pool to save him, but I couldn't. My arms wouldn't move until finally my stepfather dove in and saved him himself. And in writing this, I realized, and I wrote, but now I don't know whether that was actually me who couldn't save the boy or my sister who couldn't save the boy. But in any case, it didn't matter, because neither of us were the daughters of that man who wanted to save his son, and of course, luckily did. So there are funny ways where dealing with truth gives you more opportunity to write inventively, because you can write about the thing that isn't true and then talk about how that isn't true and why that can be interesting.
What about reading? I know you included parts of your actual diaries from then. I don't know if you constantly read them, you know, between now and the time you wrote this memoir, but what was that like, just looking that stuff over, whether it be the first time or the ninth time?
It was sickening. If you look at your diary when you're 16 years old, it's ridiculous. So I looked at it in order to glean what I could and to find where I had information that I couldn't remember. But no, I would never, ever, ever look at those diaries again. They're in a box in the basement, in a drawer or something.
You know, and getting one's father father's attention can be challenging enough. I mean, what was it like? You had two at the same, you know, what was that like anyway?
It was, I mean, it seems, I feel so, I'm so old now that it seems, it's hard to re-inhabit that mind. But when I was 11, 12, 13, 14, it mattered enormously. And in the case of the two fathers, the analogy I used to have is that one of them considered the world or his family sort of a zoo, where as long as everyone, you know, everyone was equal, everyone was fair, everything had to always be fair and even, whereas the other one, the American, considered the family sort of a jungle, and he would pit people against each other. And so between the two, between one father who would treat his own daughters the way he treated his stepdaughters, which in a way is the right thing to do, but it didn't feel that way at the time, and then the other who thought you have to compete for his attention and you have to show that you're the one worth his love, that particular combination of jungle and zoo, I think, made things all the more, I don't know, desperate between my stepsister and me in trying to be ones worthy of being loved and not worthy of being left.
Speaking of love, I just want to turn to, you have many, many other works other than the memoir. You wrote Nine Island, and I just loved the way the excerpt that I came across. So it says, so I've sailed the seas and come to, no, I've sailed no seas. I've driven south down I-95, driven south for days until 95 stopped, and I was back in Miami. No country for old women. I'm not old yet, but my heart is sick with old desire, and I'm back in this place of sensual music to see if it's time to retire from love. What a delight to be free of that maddening monster, lust. So Plato claims, Sophocles said, could be. I just love that. So tell us about that book and the topic that you chose. What's that about?
That was my most recent novel, and I called it a nonfiction novel because having written the memoir and having done some translation of the Roman poet Ovid, I got to a point where I just wasn't interested in writing fiction, really, like made-up fiction. I didn't want to make up stories. I wanted to take things that I knew, I had experienced, things that were true, and then try and find sense and order in them. So this was based on everything is, I mean, it's about 94% true stuff. And I was living in Miami, and I was trying to figure out what to do with whether I wanted to be single or not. I was ending a marriage. And I was living in a building full of very old people, and it was an old building, and it was dilapidated, and they were redoing parts of it. So I, in writing that book, I was trying to deal with more or less memoiristic stuff, but I wanted to do it as inventively as I could in terms of the language and the way it was written and the way images would repeat. So, but it is about this woman, a.k.a. me, I call her Jay, trying to decide whether she's going to quit and making up all the arguments for why love is a sickness or why to want another person means you're missing something. All the ways that it's a kind of toxicity to love or to desire. And she's sort of trying to convince herself of something that she doesn't believe. So, and I won't say how it goes. And there's also a duck involved in that story, which is one of my favorite parts, the stranded duck that I did take care of for a year or so that was left by the side of the road with hurt wings, and I would feed it every day. Anyway, so the duck is a metaphor. And it was a real duck, but it was a good, easy metaphor for this woman who was clearly not functional and trying to survive on the side of the road in a funny way.
You know, I know I'm leaving. Actually, Ellen, do you want to go to a break before I...
Yeah, sure. Let's go to a break.
I didn't realize what time it was. So
yeah.
Hold on.
That's okay. We're speaking with Jane Allison, author, professor of English at the University of Virginia, and soon we'll be talking to Daniel Fairley II. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Apropos of Something. I'm Ellen Daniels. I'm here with my co-host, Nancy Lawrence, in New York City. I am in Charlottesville, and we're speaking with Jane Allison. So, Nancy, I believe you had a question.
I did. Jane, I do. This book, and there are several others, which we most likely will not get to all of them, but you use Ovid in this book and these others. Why is he such a subject for you? And to be honest, I didn't even know of him, so feel free to rewind as far back as you want.
He's not just a subject, he's an obsession, and I need to get over him. And I'm hoping I've written the last word about him that I will ever write, because it's getting embarrassing. When I like I said, I went to a not fabulous public school in D.C., but it was fabulous enough to have a Latin teacher, and so I studied Latin, and then went to college and majored in that, and took a a course in Ovid, and I felt my brain being lifted wide open, because he wrote something called The Metamorphoses about 2,000 years ago. He was sort of the bad boy of Rome. He wrote really racy, sexy stuff, which got him in trouble, but he also wrote something called The Metamorphoses, which is this fantastic full-length book of stories within stories within stories about people being transfigured, often in a way that's punitive. Or one of the major themes he has is of girls trying to escape sex and rape and begging to be turned into stone or turned into trees or turned into water or anything to avoid it. And the stories are, I mean, they come from ancient myth, but they're he changed them all and made them in a way more contemporary and psychological even. But they seem to me to be these sort of fantastic, beautiful little diagrams of things I was really feeling. So I was in love with this boy who was very, very cold, and that fit a story he had called Echo and Narcissus, where she has nothing in her and she's worthless and he has everything and she wants to be and have him. So I read this when I was nice and 18, I think, or 19 maybe, and it just fit, it just described my life and transferred what I was feeling in a really raw adolescent way into something that was art. And it just stayed with me. So I ended up writing a novel. Oh, and the thing that happened to Ovid is he got in trouble for writing this and the sexy stuff and was exiled from Rome to live on the edge of the Black Sea where no one spoke his language. He had to learn the language, and he was never allowed home, and he died there. And no one's ever known what he did exactly. Mm-hmm. It's just that he did something that was a crime of some sort, and Augustus never forgave him. So I mean, there's no real reason to have identified with him, except I just did in my adolescent way, and it stuck. So I wrote a novel about him and came up with an idea for why he might have been banished. And then years later, I did translations of the sex stories, and then he turned up once again in Nine Island, the one we were just talking about, because the narrator is, in fact, translating Ovid. So so he's just been he's sort of a voice I have in my head often as a just incredibly clever but deeply conscious of psychological ways of reading life that he doesn't address literally, but he transforms into these images and these sort of figures of stone or rock.
I thought I read that he said that he was exiled because of a poem and an act. So do you identify at all with, you know, being a little bit persecuted or any of those sorts of things?
Well, he said a poem and an error. And the error, all he would ever say was, it was not an optical error. So it wasn't something he saw. It was something he did. And nobody knows what it was. And he wouldn't tell. I think there was a gag order and he couldn't tell. I don't think I've been persecuted. I mean, I've had a pretty privileged life, a very privileged life. But I did feel that my sense of identity was altered. I mean, it was sort of strange to lose a whole accent and a name and a nationality and, you know, a father. And so I think, in a way, I was able to just sort of put that way of seeing myself or read it through Ovid. So, you know, what happens when a young girl is sort of cast away from the home or the world she knew and becomes something else? And then when you get older and you're 16 and 17 and sex starts happening, you start being aware of your own body and boundaries and the way it changes. And that's where Ovid came right in, because girls' bodies change more than boys do, really. And we see the changes. And he would write about them in this more mythic way where someone becomes a bear. And I would think, oh, my, look, there's hair where there didn't used to be hair. So I just took him very personally as a way of reading almost everything else going on.
Mm-hmm. I think exiled is what I really meant to say. Mm-hmm. So, but thank you. That was great.
And, you know, because you were raised, you know, with a diplomat as a dad, you moved all over is my point. I was just wondering how much thought you put into the locations of your characters and how important locations are at all.
I think location is more important than character, even. I mean, I have a sort of fighting moment with students, undergrads, maybe, whatever, all students, when they talk about setting. And I keep thinking, you know, it's not setting, it's place, and it's going to outlast you by millions of years. Maybe not with anything living on it anymore, but it will be there after you. So I think that place is incredibly important. And I know growing up, I kept wondering where home was, because I was from Australia and white Australians had come from elsewhere, and I could trace my family back only a couple generations. And, you know, and then growing up in Washington and in Los Angeles and in South America, I did not know where home would be. There was a writer I like called Carol Phillips, who is from St. Kitts originally, but is now lives in England. And he said that he probably home for him would be a point in the Atlantic because of being, you know, African blood, but then St. Kitts and then England. And I always love that idea that you can sort of triangulate and imagine where home might be and what place might belong to you when really you don't own a place. You may be owned by it, but then you may easily drift from it.
And, you know, you mentioned, well, recently, well, not before the break anyway, this idea that you were a little off of just pure novels. And I was just wondering, was that the reason you wrote your current, the book that's out now, Meander, Spiral, Explode, the one that's on the process of book writing, or was that always on your mind to do?
That was actually, that came out of, I wouldn't say nowhere, but I've been teaching for, I don't know, 15 years, and I realized that the way I teach writing fiction is it kept being about ways of resisting some of the conventions that you're taught in creative writing classes and in, I mean, you can go online, for instance, and Google how to write a story, and you'll be given the same structure again and again, and it's always driven me crazy for a bunch of reasons. A, because it's prescriptive, and I don't like prescriptions at all in writing or in anything creative. And B, because this the structure that we're told to follow is an arc, a dramatic arc, and a dramatic arc is something that is closely aligned with a certain sort of male sexuality. And I had just been reading books and stories for years that did something else and took on different shapes. And so I realized I'd been teaching for years these different shapes without ever organizing my thinking. And I realized a couple of years ago that the way I had been thinking about different ways of structuring fiction could all begin to be corralled into a book. And then the book developed an idea, which was the different natural shapes that we might use to structure stories other than an arc or a wave. So stories can spiral, or they can meander, they can take all kinds of other shapes. So it's a quasi-feminist treatise, but it's really more about writing and not being told what to do.
Can you talk a little bit about maybe, or did you discover that when you were reading in German? Can you talk about that?
So I first started thinking about how to structure fiction. I was living in Germany. I graduated, I got my MFA, I got married, I moved to Germany with my husband, and I was trying to learn German, and I would meet these women every week or every few weeks to have a sort of book group, and they were German women architects, and we were reading a book by W.G. Sebald called The Emigrants, which has since then become extremely famous and influenced a lot of young writers. And he was doing something structurally that I hadn't understood or seen before, where he's working with juxtaposition, and so rather than having a storyline or an arc or anything like that that's dramatic, he had these four different parts of a story about different men who had to leave Germany for one reason or other, mostly because they were Jewish. And he just came up with a way to create a full-length novel where you, as the reader, were asked to keep thinking about how each part was related to the next, rather than following a story or a drama or a conflict. And that was really, really, really exciting. And so I began studying, you know, how he had done that, and then looking at other books like the one I just mentioned by Carol Phillips, or the author I just mentioned called Crossing the River, other writers who were doing something else that was, for good reasons, resisting more established patterns of writing, more established patterns of getting a reader to engage.
You know, these designs of nature that you're now applying, or not all at the same time, but these things you're applying to writing, what is that like when, are you teaching that? Of course you are. So what is that like when you are teaching this to your students? It's not just a story arc to kids.
I tested the idea out on undergrads last year. They didn't know this. And so we read a lot of the books that I talk about in this book, Meander, Spiral, Explode. It was interesting because I've worked with them then after this class. Some of them were my students this past year. And it was kind of great. One of them said, you know, you blew our brains. We didn't, you know, we've been told to follow the arc. We've been told that you have to have conflict and rising action and then a climax and then a denouement. And it was amazing to know that we didn't have to do that. So, I mean, I don't think they all reacted that way, but at least one did, which I thought was good news. But I think people really talk about the arc of the story. What's the arc of the story? And even ones who know better will fall into it. It's this sort of incredibly attractive force of gravity, and it's one that I want to resist.
I just want to mention your website, which is really, really great. It is JaneAllisonAuthor.com, and it's Allison with one L. Go to it. It's fantastic. There's a lot of interviews there. Maybe we'll appear on your
There's
on
an
your website.
L on the other side of the earth, right? That's where you left the other L. No.
Wow. That's right. Wow, Nancy.
I don't know. I have no idea, of course.
Okay. Anyway, and the books that we spoke about today are Meander, Spiral, Explode, Design and Pattern in Narrative, which is on the craft of writing, which we were just talking about, Nine Island, and Sisters Antipodes. But there's so much more in a lot of short stories that have been published in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and many, many, many other places. So I just wanted to thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Yeah.
Good.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
We go
also,
for that.
All of them are on Amazon as well.
Oh, so. And they're on Amazon.
And they're in indie bookstores.
Indie bookstores.
Some indie bookstores.
Yes. Thank you. I know you have to leave, so while Nancy's doing her, you have a news of note? I'm going to take a picture of these two.
Cool. I like knowing that. That's a news of note right there. Who says you don't have a news of note? Okay, so my news of note, because it is Gay Pride Month, my news of note is about a gentleman in college right now. His name is Seth Owen. He was last year a gay high school valedictorian who made headlines when he had a GoFundMe page made by his, I believe it was a science teacher, but regardless, he had donors help him go achieve his dream to go to Georgetown, which is where he is right now. But this year, he's paying it forward. He's created a scholarship for other LGBTQ students with similar to him volatile home situations to pursue their secondary education. He's using his extra money, and he got money from Ellen DeGeneres. It's called his fund is called Unbroken Horizons, and this year he's giving out $2,500 scholarships to students.
Wow. Thanks for that, Nance. Thanks for the Gay Pride mention.
Exactly.
So our next guest is Daniel Fairley II. He graduated from the University of Richmond in 2013 and 1 year later began interning at the White House in the Obama administration. He received his master's at the University of Vermont in higher education and student affairs, where he received awards for his dedication to social justice and stellar academics. Since 2017, Daniel became the Youth Opportunity Coordinator for the City of Charlottesville with the directive to focus on black male achievement. He now also serves on the board of directors for 100 Black Men of Central Virginia and Loaves and Fishes Food Pantry. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hello, hello.
You, reading all that, it seems like you should
haven't
be...
accomplished enough.
I know.
That's what Ellen was...
That's what I'm trying... I mean, you really...
Not enough.
You should be older is what I'm also thinking. So let's start with the White House, mm-hmm. so we can reflect back to those nostalgic days of
yes,
the Obama.
The glory days.
The glory days. So how did that come about, and what was that experience like?
Yeah, so that came about, I mean, through, in many ways, a lot of government jobs are known through just getting to know people, right? So having connections. So I was basically a program director or like kind of student leader of a small peer mentoring group inside of University of Richmond, called the Peer Advising Mentors. That then led to a group of small colleges in Virginia with peer advising mentors, clubs at their schools, which so there was like seven of us, seven schools that came together to Mary Baldwin College. And at that point, one of the guest speakers was Christian Peel, who was then director of the White House internship program. While we were there talking to her, I just made some connections and had always been told to make sure that you follow up with people once you're connected with them, especially if they do something that you're really interested in. And so after I made those connections, her and I got lunch or coffee the other, like during, sometime later on that year. And she said, you know, it would be really great if you would apply for the program and just kind of see if you're interested, in working in my office or working with the White House Operations Office. So I applied, interviewed a couple months later, and then was accepted. And so I worked inside of White House Operations, doing a bunch of different things, mostly booking rooms and some other mundane task. But also I was able to work on the Diversity and Inclusivity Committee, which kind of brought together different people from around the White House, as well as, you know, Secret Service or other agencies to make the White House more inclusive. So I get the people's house.
So not to gloss over that. Mm-hmm. So some of your accomplishments, I could rattle them off, but would you like to do that?
Yeah, I mean, it was the accomplishments of the group that were just fantastic. Because of that group, we now all of the basically anything that comes out of the White House on like a video comes with automatic closed captioning now. We have accessible routes that are highlighted through the visitors' maps and when you're coming to visit the White House. They have all brand new wheelchairs, or they say were brand new in 2014, wheelchairs that are at every single exit. And then also, I mean, just because of the work that I had done with social justice, I had learned about gender inclusive restrooms and just kind of making sure that everyone feels welcome, that we were able to get 3 gender inclusive restrooms put inside the White House, which is the first 3 in history. And so that was just amazing to know that there were spaces where people could feel comfortable and they didn't need to be assigned or put into a box. They could just go and use the bathroom. Mm-hmm. So it was really cool. It was just an amazing group of people to work with.
Hopefully they will be utilized and appreciated in the next administration.
Yes, yeah. Hopefully so. Yeah.
Well, whichever stuff still remains, you know, someone else is taking credit for that right now.
That's true, too.
You can be sure. But that does sound truly, that sounds amazing, especially because you were an intern, or is that the correct, that's what you were,
yeah,
right, mm-hmm. while you were there?
Yeah, I was an intern, and it's pretty cool, because when you have interns that have really great ideas, like one of the other interns inside of, I can't remember if she was in our class or the class after us, but basically, the White House will come up with different colors that they will paint the White House. Let's say red during, you know, remembrance for HIV and AIDS, pink during breast cancer awareness. And so one of the interns basically suggested that we paint the White House in rainbow colors. And that was like an intern suggestion that now is a really iconic symbol of the White House. So it's pretty cool to know that like there are interns that are able to have such influence and such great opportunities when they have a good idea, they can just say them and present them to different people, and they can say, you know what, that's a great idea. We're going to actually implement that and showcase that for the world to see.
So we're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be right back with Daniel Fairley II. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something, and we're speaking with Daniel Fairley II.
Hey, Daniel, I was wondering, when you moved to Charlottesville, I know you were working at UVA, and what were your responsibilities there?
Yeah, so at UVA, I was an area coordinator, working inside of the Housing and Residence Life Office.
And what was the work you were doing that caught the attention of the, you know, city of Charlottesville to get the job that you're currently doing?
So basically, I wanted to just get more involved. I think when you're, you know, an active kid that wants to get into college, you start volunteering a little bit more and being involved in the community that you're in so you can kind of get those accolades and everything. And then once I went to University of Richmond, I realized like, man, I really enjoyed that involvement. And I started getting involved both on campus and off campus. Same thing when I went to University of Vermont. And then I got to a real, real full-time job. And I was like, you know what? I have time on my hands, and I'm in a community that I really should be more invested in. This is a community of people that I'm feeling close to, that I want to make sure that I'm giving back. And so as I was doing that, I heard actually advertisement on the radio to be involved with the Dialogue on Race and be a facilitator, because they were looking for some people to work there. And I said, you know what, I've had a lot of facilitation experience working at social justice retreats, and just being at the University of Vermont, you kind of are always facilitating social justice dialogues. And after I did that, I said, you know, I'm going to go ahead and be involved inside of this. So I got involved with the Dialogue on Race inside the city of Charlottesville. And I also started volunteering with 100 Black Men and their MCUBE program, which is like the Math, Men, and Mission program that is a 2-week academy during the summertime. And we're teaching kids not just about academics and preparing them for the next year in their new math classes, but also working with them on what it means to be a man, right? And kind of getting some young men, getting them together to think about, excuse me, how can we be better men as we grow in the future?
So tell us what the issues are that you're facing and that you see in the city of Charlottesville and elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think is always really important that I'm seeing is this idea, this perception that young Black men have about themselves and that other people have about young Black men, right? So we have this narrative that maybe young Black men are lazy, or that they are only into sports, or that they may not be intelligent. And so I think that narrative is just so toxic, right? It's toxic for the environment, and it's toxic for the young men that I'm working with. And so when they only see themselves in negative lights, or they only see the negative portrayals of, you know, someone that maybe was robbing a liquor store or things like that inside of the city. It's just kind of like, man, if this is all that I'm seeing about myself, or this is all that maybe my friends are doing, or maybe all that, all that we experience, and how can we make sure that on my end, we are giving them a different narrative? How do we change the narrative of what young Black men are seeing? Because what we realize is that what you see is what you'll be, right? So if you only see negative parts of yourself, you only see people that look negative and they look like you, then how can you have a positive role model? How can you work towards positive, you know, accolades in life when you only see negative things? So I think that the work that I'm trying to do is making sure that we are changing the narrative, not just for the young Black men inside themselves, but also for the teachers and the principals and the Boys and Girls Club staff and people that are just working with these kids and may have negative perceptions of them. How can we make sure and show and highlight all the beautiful things that they're doing?
So in what ways are you helping to do that specifically?
Yeah. So last year we had a Change in the Narrative documentary that came out. Young men, they were just so amazing. There were four young men inside of the Community Attention Youth Internship Program that I recruited to then work with myself, Clarence Green with Underground Shorts, and Lighthouse Studio to create a documentary on changing the narrative. These kids had the idea of interviewing some older Black men and just kind of figure out, hey, what did you do? How did you get to where you are? Because all of the men that we interviewed were people that, one was a chef, right? Antoine Brinson. We had another person that is the executive director of Abundant Life Ministries. That's Nathan Walton. Cleve Packer Sr., who is a vice president at the Virginia Lottery. We started interviewing people that were quote unquote successful, or quote, that had an idea that they maybe faced some challenges and faced some different adversarial moments. And we wanted to see, what did you do? How did you get to where you are? And so giving them the opportunity to write the questions, to interview the candidates, to get all the filming, the editing, music, I mean, everything that goes into a documentary, we just kind of gave them the opportunity, right? So my boss would say, when you tell your kids they need to brush their teeth at night, right? You say, hey, you need to brush your teeth tonight. I don't care what toothbrush you use. I don't care what toothpaste. You figure that out, right? But at the end of the day, your teeth need to be brushed. And so that's what we did with them, right? At the end of the day, we need a documentary. And they said, okay, cool. We're going to pick the people. We're going to just run with this. And it was so amazing to see the creativity and the joy that came out of these young men that had never thought about filmmaking before. And so one of them ended up going to TCU, and instead of studying sports broadcasting as he originally envisioned, he actually went into film studies and then did so well at TCU that he came back for Lighthouse Studios and now is working there as a teaching assistant, helping teach other kids how to be involved in film.
And how are you, because probably more than one way. So what are the ways that you're trying to get high school kids, you know, the attention of them, or bring them into these city council meetings for all I know? How are you engaging high school kids?
Yeah. So one of the ways that I'm engaging high school kids is I'm working with the Charlottesville Youth Council. So myself and Gretchen Ellis are advisors for the Charlottesville Area Youth Council. And with that youth council, we just take issues that are prevalent inside the community, right? So if we see there, right after August 11th and 12th, the dialogue around race was really big, and there were people trying to figure out, what can we do? How can we make a more equitable society? And I said, you know what? Let's get youth voice involved in this. Let's see what the kids have to say, because they're in our community and they have thoughts. Let's make sure that we're including them in our conversations. And so we had a Charlottesville, like a youth dialogue on race inside the city schools, where we brought in kids from Buford and CHS to the Jefferson School and had an entire dialogue with affinity groups and just being able to talk about their differences and similarities. That was back in the fall, February of 2018. And then after the New York Times article came out last year in October, the kids said, hey, we are really struggling with this. There are people, there are parents that are being communicated with. There are teachers and faculty members, and are asking them about, what can we do to make the schools more equitable? But what they weren't doing was talking to other kids, right? If we're figuring out how to make the schools more equitable, we're figuring out how to give the kids a better experience, they should be involved in that conversation. They actually should be the head of that conversation, because this is affecting their lives. So we ended up working with the kids to then facilitate focus groups all throughout the Charlottesville City Schools inside of Buford and CHS. And the kids actually led the focus groups, talked with parents, sorry, not talk with parents, they talked with other kids inside of classrooms, and we are able to just get some class time, and they interviewed over, I want to say around 400 different kids to ask them about their experiences, anywhere from AP Latin to academic math and everything in between. And so it was a really eye-opening experience for me just as a scribe and a note taker to hear what these kids are going through. What are the difficulties that they may have in, you know, student lunches or walking the halls as an ESL student or English language learner student? How can you see the different points of view that these kids are bringing and making sure that we are listening to them? And so in that, I see myself as just a holder of the microphone, right? These kids have ideas. They have beautiful minds. And so I'm here to hold the microphone and I'm here to hold the people accountable. And so what we did was we then set them up with a meeting with Dr. Atkins, as well as an opportunity to speak at the school board and give a presentation about all of their facts and findings, not just the issues that they saw, but also suggestions they had for moving forward. We did that for the school board and for the city council. And just last night, I know that you all inside the city may have heard about some changes that are coming to the Quest program. And a lot of those changes were changes that were suggested by the kids, making sure that you're testing every kid for Quest, making sure that you are getting people not just at first grade, but giving everyone the opportunity to gain some of those skills that sometimes may only be available to the privileged students. And so seeing the ways in which our kids had suggestions and had ideas, and then bringing them and holding that mic for them in front of city council, in front of the school board, and saying, hey, these kids need a voice and they need a way to express what they're thinking.
How is the dynamic like that you personally have at your job? Do you propose things to your boss? How does that work, that when you have an idea?
Right. So, I mean, a lot of times I get my ideas from kids. There are kids that say, hey, we want to do something really cool. So last year when we talked to the kids about the documentary, they said, you know, we really want to interview some people and kind of hear from older people about how to get to where they are. And then when I talked to them at the very end, I said, what would you want to do next year? And they said, man, it'd be so cool. I have a lot of friends that are doing cool things. I would love to feature them and kind of take hold of our own narrative and be able to change the narrative with ourselves, right? I want to show something to my teachers to say, hey, you may think that my friend is really tired and always sleeping in your class and that he may be lazy or not engaged, but what you don't realize is that he is actually the older brother to four other kids and that his mom works two shifts. And so he has to, you know, feed all the kids. He has to make sure that they're all safe by the end of the night and then stays up at night to make sure his mom also gets home safely. And so when he's doing all those things, it takes up all of his time and he doesn't have time to sleep, right? So he takes an opportunity in that safe space to sleep inside of your class, but you don't realize that because you may only see the sleeping in your class. And so I think that those are the things that I do. I listen to kids and I hear what they want to do and how they are wanting to express themselves. And I just run with it, right? I hold the microphone and I make sure that I am being an advocate for them.
So what are two specific elements or critical elements that you think in your experience help change this narrative?
So I think that some of the things, I mean, one, it's again, the what they'll see is what they'll be, right? Making sure that you are focusing and highlighting positive people and giving them the opportunity to see other positive Black male role models inside the city, or even just around them. And then also another one I want to say is just, It's kind of unmeasurable in some ways, but this idea of self-efficacy, this idea that I can do something, right? I can do even more than maybe what I see, or I can be someone and I believe in myself. And so that's something that I really want to embrace and embody in the kids. One of the kids I interviewed for the KIA program, we have a question of what's your dream job? What do you want to do when you grow up? And one kid said, I want to be a manager of a CVS. And I said, okay, that's a very specific goal. Like, how did you get to a manager of a CVS specifically? And he said, well, I can see it from my house. And for him, that idea that everything around me, all the things that I can see, that's that's all that I can do, right? And so what I want to do is I want to broaden that kid's horizons. I want to make sure that there are opportunities and that he's able to see anything and everything that he could ever be.
You know, Daniel, I read that there is a black boy book club, otherwise known as the SWAG Reading Book Club.
Yes.
First of all, is it in effect, and is it still in effect in the summertime?
So we actually, it was like a trial period in which we worked with some kids from West Haven, as myself, Rob Gray at the City of Promise, as well as Justin Reed inside of Virginia Humanities. And with that book club, I mean, it was SWAG Reading because that's what the kids named it. We kind of asked them, you know, what do you want to name it? And they said, you know what, SWAG Reading, let's do some swag stuff. And I was like, okay, sure. but it was an opportunity that was just so impactful, because we were able to not just give the kids books with black kids inside of them, but also have them read books written by black authors. And with the connection with the Virginia Humanities and also the timing that it went through the Virginia Festival of the Book, we actually had a couple of black authors come in that we were reading and get to meet the kids. And so the expression on those kids' faces when they saw an author that, you know, it's kind of like when you maybe meet the farmer that puts the groceries inside of your store and you're like, wait, I know that I just picked these apples up from the store, but now I realize that there's a person who's out there picking or growing these apples, right? And so the kids to be able to say, oh my God, you wrote this book? Like you're a writer? Was something that they had never seen before. And so having those opportunities available for the kids, again, seeing things that they never have seen before. It was actually my first time ever meeting a black author of like children's books. And so it was so cool for them to have that experience. And I want to make sure that we're giving that to everyone.
So I just wanted to mention how you can reach the Alliance for Black Male Achievement. Can you rattle that off?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's everything is BMACville. That's like for Be Black Male Achievement, Cville. So that's on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, BMACville at charlottesville.org. And so all of those are just anywhere you want to reach us. It's always BMACville.
And so if a person wanted... So if there's somebody who is unaffiliated with anything out there, he wanted to get involved, would they just contact you?
Exactly.
And then you would take them under your wing, listen closely, and help them out?
Yes, absolutely. And another thing that we're looking for right now is I'm looking for kids that are doing just really special things in our community. So if you know any young black men that are doing just really cool stuff. Cool things like we have an accomplished pianist that's playing at people's weddings. We're looking into interviewing maybe someone that does karate and teaches karate in a local studio. I want to just broaden this idea of what young black men can do, both for the adults and the kids that see it.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Daniel Fairley II. Really enjoyed it. A lot more questions, so maybe you'll come back and we'll talk to you. I hope you stick around in the city for a while.
He'll be running the city by the
time. I know you're going to be running the
next
city.
Next Saturday, anyway. No.
Right. I'll be your guest somewhere, I'm sure.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you very much. You're too kind.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Hey, Nancy. You know what it's time for? The palate cleanser. Do you have a palate cleanser?
I do. And I don't know if Jane is still there, but I'm referencing her dramatic arc that we spoke of in Nature earlier. This is about the reflection, refraction, and dispersion of light in water droplets, which results in the spectrum of light, otherwise known as a rainbow. Which is very fitting for the month, you know.
No lie.
It comes from an optical illusion caused by these water droplets when viewed from a certain angle. It's a meteorological phenomenon, but also a cultural phenomenon, especially during June, Gay Pride Month. That is my palate cleanser.
Thank you. Such a good friend, an ally for bringing all that up. My palate cleanser is that, well, you may have read that by 2050, the ocean may have more plastic than fish, and that every piece of plastic still exists today that was made in the world. But what I discovered is there's a lot of swimwear companies making bathing suits out of plastic and other things. So there's a website. Fair Harbor is one of those brands. Outer Known is another. And the website that has a lot of these resources is Good On You. So they're making bathing suits out of post-consumer recycled plastic bottles, as I mentioned, and recycled fishing nets and nylon surplus. Anyway, there's a lot more on that, but I found that encouraging, at least. So
that is very encouraging. I didn't think this was going to talk about an arc. I didn't think it was going to end in a good place.
So that's, I know.
That's a so spin on that. Yeah.
Buy your swimwear from these places. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Daniel and Jane, and thanks, Nancy, for being with me every Saturday morning.
Indeed.
Remember, our music is by Springtide, and that no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Join hosts Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by Table 44 in Stanton and Moxie Hair Lounge on Preston Avenue in Charlottesville. Show archives can be found at 947wpvc.org, or you can subscribe on iTunes.